tell me and tell all your listeners, is now an exciting time to be an immunologist?
It's a brilliant time to be an immunologist. We really have an advent of these new tools that are coming online that allow us to answer questions that just couldn't be answered several years ago. We can now sequence entire genomes of individuals to try to match up variation in the genome to the variation in the immune system. We can also use strategies such as single cell sequencing to look at the heterogeneity that is present within an immune population. Previously, we were trapped by looking at bulk populations and these assumptions that all of the cells in the immune system in a particular subset were the same. Now we know that's not the case, and we can really use these new tools to try to dissect that heterogeneity.
So first of all, let's hear about your lab's gene discovery program and the recent paper that has just come out.
We've had a number of successes on this front. One of the most recent ones just came out in Science Translational Medicine. And in this paper, what we did is we took a large family that had a disease of inflammation of the skin, very severe skin lesions. What we were able to do is sequence the genomes, get to the gene, and then not only find the mutation in the gene, but go further into the mechanism and find out how that mutation is actually causing disease. The great thing in this case is that the mechanism of disease was an excessive production of a simple single cytokine, interleukin-1 beta. And there happens to be a drug that targets interleukin-1 beta. And the responses were amazing in the preliminary trials that we ran. And it looks like this is going to be a disease that when it's diagnosed in the future should be able to be treated very simply, very effectively from a single drug. We have also looked at another disease called FHL. This is familial hemophagocytic lymphohistiocytosis. And in this disease, patients come in that have had an infectious trigger, and then they have this very severe inflammatory bout that cannot be controlled. The genetics of this disease, FHL, have been known for a while. It's caused by mutations in the gene perforin or other genes downstream. These mutations stop the ability of T cells or NK cells to kill infected cells. Now, surprisingly enough, the main clinical symptoms are not a defect in responding to infections, but rather an over-response that occurs. Now, what we did is we tried to work out in a mouse model of this disease why you had this separation between a defect in clearing a virus and excessive immune response downstream. And it turns out that when you can't use one arm of the immune system, that of the perforin pathway, you end up using a different arm, that of interferon gamma production. Now, when you are excessively activating the second arm of the immune response against the viruses, the excessively activated cells, they are then able to suck out of the system all of a cytokine called IL-2. Now, unfortunately, IL-2 is essential for another cell type, the regulatory T cell. And once you've lost the regulatory cells, the entire immune system just starts activating on a massive scale.
You've actually done some work on how regulatory T cells maintain this homeostasis.
Regulatory T cells are absolutely critical for suppressing the immune response. If you have too many, you're going to be immune suppressed. If you have too few, you're going to have inflammatory diseases because you can't stop immune activation. So you want just the right amount. This means we really need to have a mechanism that controls the number of regulatory T cells that are in the system, making sure that they're in this nice Goldilocks zone of not too much, not too few. What we find is that there is a strong feedback loop where extra activated cells drive the production of extra regulatory cells. And conversely, when regulatory cells are too high, they're shutting down the activated arm, which means that they're also going to be shut down in turn by these regulatory loops that are maintained.
Now, type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease, and your labs looked at this disease from the angle of the target tissue.
What we did is we used a model of type 1 diabetes, the non-obese diabetic mouse, or the NOD mouse, and we tried to investigate what are the factors that are causing diabetes in the NOD mouse. What we found is that if we added on stress onto the beta cells, the target tissue of diabetes, the beta cells from the NOD mouse were very fragile, while the beta cells of other mouse strains were very robust. Now, this was not immunological in nature. This was really a primary defect of the beta cells. Now, it turns out that in the NOD mouse, this is quite a simple genetic trait. There are two genes that are polymorphic in the NOD mouse, which means that the NOD beta cells, when they get stressed, they're more likely to die rather than survive, and they're also more likely to undergo senescence because they can't repair DNA breaks as well. We then wanted to work out whether or not the same variation existed in humans. And we see again that there is this relationship between islets that seem to be more programmed to die upon stress and islets that were less likely to repair double-stranded DNA breaks. One of the exciting possibilities that comes out of this is that if we know that fragile beta cells are a problem, it's something that we can target. We can design drugs to try to make beta cells tougher. Now, the mouse model we developed for this is really the first mouse model that's available to investigate whether or not drugs make islets tougher. It's also something that we can then start using to screen a completely new class of anti-diabetic drugs, the first time we have a mouse model to allow us to do this.
And have you any idea what's causing the weak islets?
Certainly, in the context of the NOD mouse, it's a very simple genetic trait. Now, in humans, it's probably much more complex. There are a few genes that are good candidates for making islets either robust or fragile, but the other really good candidate is that of diet. We know in mice, we can make even mice that have robust islets, we can make their islets fragile by giving them more fat in their diet. I think the same thing is probably going to be happening in humans. Certainly in vitro, you can do the same effects on human islets. This also potentially explains the epidemiology of diabetes. It's a genetic disease, but is it increasing at an exponential rate? Now, how does this happen? Well, the only explanation can be that our environment has changed. And one of the primary changes in our environment has been a change in diet.
And your lab's also been working on the variation in the immune system from person to person.
Several studies have just come out recently saying that about 20 to 40% of the variation is genetic. However, it does mean that something like 60 to 80% of the variation is completely unknown and unstudied, because this part of the variation is non-genetic, it's environmental. We set up a study to try to understand what is the environmental driver of variation in the immune system. The way we studied this is to generate an immune phenotyping platform where we could really measure the variation between individual to individual, and then to roll out this platform over hundreds and hundreds of individuals.
And so what factors look to be responsible for this variation in the immune system?
There are a lot of minor factors that came up. BMI, sex, these factors were able to make little tweaks to the immune system. One of the biggest factors, however, is age. As you age, you have a progressive change to your immune system. Very young individuals have an immune system which is full of precursor cells that are ready to develop, while older individuals have an immune system that is really polarized to a type 1 inflammatory response. Now, the largest effect that we saw was actually an effect of cohabitation. People in the couple had an immune system that was about 50% more similar than they would be to a random stranger. Now, remember that genetics accounts for about 25% of the variation, so having 50% of your variation disappear just because you happen to be living together with no genetic background, that's extremely potent.
And so what is it about living with someone that means that this immune profile is transferred?
I think when you're living with someone, there's going to be multiple different environmental factors that are going to be shared. You're going to be more likely to have the same diet, the same exercise patterns, sleep patterns, stress, and you're also going to start to share the same microbiome. The couples that we were looking at, these couples had a small child living at home. Now here I think the child is going to act as a vector to increase the microbiome exchange even further, because of course you're changing nappies, you have maybe reduced hygiene levels in the household, and if you have enhanced microbiome transfer, we could imagine that the immune systems are going to be becoming even more similar in that case.
What are the future directions for your lab? Are you going to keep this sort of multi-pronged approach?
I think it's very important in science never to get bored. And for me, this often means bringing up new topics, exploring new diseases, exploring new pathways. There is a common thread that runs through this, however, and that thread is going from the variation that's present within individuals, how that variation changes our immune system, and how the immune system then interacts with a tissue in order to cause disease. The areas in which we want to explore further coming up are specifically to increase our gene discovery system, really be able to identify new mutations, new diseases. The other area that I'm really interested in is how the immune system adapts to the environment of a tissue as opposed to the immune system acting in circulation. So often, as an immunologist, we start thinking of the immune system as something that can be replicated in a single cell suspension. Flow cytometry has really revolutionized the way we do immunology, but it does give you this idea that a single cell suspension recapitulates an immune system. Of course it doesn't. Immune cells are not present just in blood or in a disorganized tissue like the spleen. Really, the immune system has to percolate into the tissues. And in the tissues, you're going to have anatomical spacing that's going to be important. You're going to have the relationship of the immune cells with the non-immune cells around it. And for this, we need to look at the cells in the context, in situ, how they're interacting with the organ. This is something that I see as being really important for future research.